Morgan Startup Series.
Hi, it's Chris Titley here, and as part of the Morgan's Startup Series, I'm joined by Matt Fairhurst, co-founder and CEO of Schedulo. Matt, thanks so much for being on the call.
You're welcome, Chris. Really a pleasure to be chatting. Thanks for having me.
Matt, can you tell us about Schedulo, the concept, the idea, the name, the history, and basically how it all began?
We formed about 3.5 years ago in Brisbane in Australia. My co-founder James and I had been working in and around the Salesforce.com ecosystem for a while. We built another product that was mildly successful, and it's actually still running today in a few customers, but that was sort of a very light ERP or sort of order-to-invoice app that we built natively on top of the Salesforce platform. And it was out of that experience and learning, and I think being exposed to so many different types of businesses in Australia initially, that we kept seeing the same repeated use case of all of these companies that, you know, certainly back then, and I'm sort of thinking now maybe 4 to 4.5 years ago, were starting to realize that all of their employees or their contractors or, you know, the workforce had a really powerful machine in the palm of their hand. And whether it was through sort of a bring-your-own-device strategy where people were bringing a smartphone from home or, you know, devices that the company had provided, they realized that they had this tool that would allow them to, you know, unanimously and across the entire workforce in their organization start sending work out to the field and managing their schedules and getting them to the right place at the right time. And this was particularly relevant for businesses that had, you know, for decades or, you know, as part of a new type of business or a new type of economy, started sending their workforce out into the field and traveling around and doing work transactionally in people's homes or at other companies' locations or whatever it was that they're doing. And there really was no category of product that catered well to this kind of new paradigm. There is a category that we're often compared to, you know, in the field service automation category, which really kind of started off 10, 15 years ago with these very, very big companies like huge telecommunication companies and utility companies and energy type organizations as well, or big manufacturers that were sort of servicing these, you know, multi-million dollar assets, and they had this very expensive employee out in the field in his van with $1 million worth of inventory. That was certainly a software category that has been developed for the last 15 years in sort of traditional field service. And it's very expensive, takes a long time typically to implement, but obviously a very high-value product for those types of companies. But the reality is that telcos and utilities and big manufacturers are not today the only people that, you know, have a workforce that is mobile. And in fact, many of, you know, the customers that we cater to today and love servicing, like healthcare, for example, so aged care and disability services in the home, they've been sending people out to deliver those kind of services for decades, if not centuries. It just so happens that, you know, this convergence of the price point of mobile technology and all of the associated technology around geolocation and tracking people and calculating travel time and powerful sort of distributed computing and all that kind of thing has meant that now is a really wonderful time for a company like us to look at, you know, what was largely only being done for those big field service type industries and look at, you know, by 2020, the 70 million people in the US alone that are going to be doing transactional work in the field out from behind a desk. So that was the use case that we experimented with across a few pilot customers in the early days, James and myself, and it was off their success, off, you know, experimenting with them in Australia, that we decided to completely pivot and form Schedulo and build a company around that problem and got really excited about it. The name itself, you know, it obviously relates to scheduling, although it is spelt much like many SaaS product companies with unique spelling. To be honest, mate, it was more about finding a URL and a web domain in those
domain
days.
Domain.com.
Exactly. We wanted a .com. And, you know, schedule. I think a name in and of itself is something that you make it over time. It is a bit of a funky name, and certainly over here in the US, where we sell a lot to customers and work a lot with our partners, they probably struggle with the pronunciation a little more than Australians. But you know, I think as the brand builds, the name becomes a byproduct of the success of the company. So that was the story behind the name. It's fairly, it's not a very sexy story. It's more about finding a URL with a .com.
That's all good. I noticed in your accent, look, just a slight twang. You said you formed the company in Brisbane, but you're calling in from San Francisco. Can you talk about, you know, the movement and the growth of the company and what led you to the epicenter of the tech world?
Yeah, absolutely. And now that you've said that, I'm going to have to overcorrect and harden up my Australian accent. Yeah, I mean, really, to be honest, we've been global from day one. And I think we definitely set out building the company and building the product, knowing that the shores of Australia were definitely not the limit to this problem and our ability to solve this problem for businesses. It's a global problem. It's a universal problem across organizations that, you know, meet this kind of characteristic. And, you know, right from the start, we were selling into the US and solving these challenges. And for the first 12 months, really, and maybe a bit longer than that, I was doing all of that remotely. So I'd sort of travel here maybe for a week at a time and see important prospects and our partners, you know, and try and do deals as much as I could when I was here. But, you know, honestly, for the first year, it was more about me not sleeping very much and staying up till, you know, working through on the Australian day and then having dinner and maybe sleeping through till about 11, 12 midnight and then waking up again and working through till 3 or 4 in the morning, getting on calls to the US. And, yeah, I mean, it was a pretty brutal schedule, but it was also super exciting, I think, to be able to solve this problem globally. And the US still represents our largest market and our largest body of customers. So, that was a tough year, but won some awesome and amazing customers, you know, very, you know, big logos and certainly bigger than ones that we thought we would be able to land in those early days, like Johns Hopkins Medicine in Baltimore, which is a, you know, a global name in medicine, and a few others, like Boingo Wireless, which is, I think, the fourth or fifth largest telco in the US at that point. And I think, you know, as with any company's growth, you're sort of trying to put out fires and hire the best people to, you know, to carve off areas of responsibility that you do as a co-founder, but then you have to find people that are far better than you at it. And we hired our first employee in the US about a year in, and then we really kind of doubled down on that and started hiring a slightly larger team here probably about 18 months ago, which coincided with my move to the US. And I still travel between the US and Australia quite a bit personally, but I'm based here in San Francisco, where for the most part our sales and marketing operation exists and product management and things like that. And Australia is still where we build the product and do all of our design, and all of our engineers sit in our Brisbane office, which is great. We have a small office in Sydney, and we also have a lovely office of 16, 17 people in Vietnam, which is one of my favorite countries as well. So it's a really healthy and diverse mix all over the world, sitting behind Schedulo and the company.
Fantastic. When you were scaling up the business you mentioned before and adding employees, I mean, was that on the back of winning these new jobs? And did you have to sort of seek capital at the time, or raise capital? And have you raised capital, or are you looking to sort of grow as the business builds out?
We certainly raised capital. I think, you know, any SaaS company selling enterprise technology, it's very difficult to build a company, you know, and I think meet the velocity at which you need to operate to capitalize on the market opportunity. But, you know, secondly, I think just from a matter of growth, it's very difficult to grow quickly and achieve what you need to achieve without raising capital. That said, I think there's some wonderful businesses that have been able to do it, you know, profitably from day one, and they're amazing journeys in and of themselves. But for us, it made sense to raise. We've done, I guess, three rounds. We did an initial angel investment round, and Paul Mansfield, who's I guess my mentor and the third co-founder at Schedulo, we'd worked with in the past, and he, along with a few other private investors in Brisbane, seeded us in the early days, and he's continued to be a member of the board and play an active role in supporting James and myself as we've grown the company. You know, I think when you look back, it's very important to recognize the investors and the people that have that really believed in you when you were nothing, really, and it was just an idea. And we were very fortunate to have some financial back in the early days to grow a small team around the product. Then we were also very fortunate, I think, to meet the guys, Nikki and Rick from Blackbird. I think certainly when we raised money with Blackbird at the end of 2014, that was, I guess, our late seed round. You know, I think they're such a wonderful example of what venture capital should look like in Australia. I think they've played such a big part in, you know, changing the landscape of venture capital in Australia, certainly from, you know, into one that's much more founder-friendly and focused on long-term investments that, you know, can really build into wonderful billion-dollar companies and form the basis of, you know, what the Australian technology industry should look like. We raised money with them at the end of 2014, and that's been a great relationship, and they've continued to invest since. And then we raised a Series A here in the US with Cosanoa Ventures in the Bay. So Blackbird again participated in that round, and we also had Rampersand in Melbourne participate in both of those rounds as well. But Blackbird led the first one, Cosanoa led the second. So, yeah, that's our history with raising money. You know, it's been a wonderful journey, I think, with all of those investors. And it's, you know, we couldn't have done it without their support and encouragement, certainly at the velocity at which we've done it. And I think that's the big thing with raising money, is raising so you can do things quickly and capitalize on opportunity.
I certainly echo those words about Paul, a great bloke here in Brisbane, and also and Nikki and Rick at Blackbird, a previous podcast of mine with Nikki, a fabulous business that they've set up, and as you mentioned, very, very integral into the Australian ecosystem and doing wonderful things and running wonderful events throughout the year as well. So some good followers and some good backers that you've got there, Matt, and hopefully that continues into a, you know, 2, 3, 5 years. And speaking of which, yeah, and you know, building out and building out the plan of being global from day one, what is the plan over the next, say, 12 months or so to build out the business and perhaps the challenges of scaling fast? And you mentioned the word velocity. What are the challenges behind velocity? Is it finding the right people or building the culture, or is it getting the customers?
To be honest, I think it's a combination of all three, but some wouldn't exist without the other. I think if you don't focus on customer acquisition, then there's no point in focusing on culture, because quite frankly, it won't exist in a year anyway if you really don't get the customers to support your growth or even to support your own sustainability. So I think some are more important than others, but all equal components of building a great company and scaling a great company. You know, I think that one of the lessons that I've learned over the last 3 years is that hiring the right people at the right time, and maybe even slightly before the right time, is so critical as a founder. And I think I'm always pushing myself to find the best possible people that we can to build this company, because at the end of the day, you do reach a point where individual contributions from co-founders you know, be move the needle far less than the contribution of the collective team and the company and all of those that work in it and for it. So, you know, finding people is super critical. And if I think about even the last 18 months, we sort of started 2016 with, I think, 22 people globally. And now we're We're now close to 80. So it's been a fairly aggressive growth from just people and team size over the last 18 months. From a revenue growth, it's been really rewarding as well. And we've got some pretty big targets for the end of this year, and then possibly raising more money next year to sort of facilitate what people would typically call growth and scale, really kind of proving out that model of, have you really found product market fit? Do your customers love it? Are they staying with you for a long time and continuing to grow in and of themselves? Have you got a repeatable model of go-to-market and sales and communicating that product value to the market? And have you validated that there is indeed a wonderful market there that would buy your product if they knew about it? And I think once you've got those things nailed, then the next sort of season for us is figuring out how to pour fuel on that fire and scale, with some of those points proven. And I think we're still in a little bit of that proving ground of really kind of building out a sales team that's really effective, building out a marketing and go-to-market model that's really, really effective, and refining some of those edges before we think about what sort of doubling, tripling that up looks like from a team perspective. So, yeah, it's a really exciting phase that we're in right now, actually. It's a great team and a great product, and it's just a fun season to be in, figuring out some of these high-quality problems and then looking to ways of scaling it.
Certainly does, and certainly very exciting from a global point of view, being based in San Francisco and also having offices in Vietnam and Australia, etc. You mentioned the word product before. Let's talk about how you evolve your product. Is it customer feedback driven, or do you want to be ahead of the curve and give the customer something that they don't know about and then need to embrace?
I think it's always a little bit of both, and so for some product companies, you're leaning more one way than the other. And I think it largely depends on the kind of product you're building and the kind of value that it brings to customers. And I think there's also a bit of a difference between companies that can use their own product and do use their own product every day. If you think about, Atlassian or Slack or Campaign Monitor, or one of those organizations where they themselves actually physically use their product on a daily basis and therefore can be, a wonderful internal contributor to, why the product sucks or what it needs to do better or what feature doesn't work and how it needs to improve, or, what are the struggles that they're experiencing in their day-to-day life as a technology company that their product could make better. We don't fit into that camp necessarily, because we're not a company that sends people out into the field. We're not a service delivery organization that has 100 people seeing people in the home or delivering some kind of audit in a business. So we do rely probably heavier than the former example on feedback from customers, and I think the rely extremely heavily on understanding their pain very acutely in order to solve their problem. That said, though, I think it's the responsibility of any tech company that is sort of, or any product company that's positioning themselves as a really high quality product that's innovative, to also be pushing the curve from an internal innovation point of view, because there are some things that customers just don't know yet, because, the technology may not exist. And if you think about sort of machine learning and artificial intelligence, there may not be sort of forethought ways that a customer has considered how to use that technology and apply it to their problem. And that's our responsibility as a product company to innovate and focus on how to differentiate through innovation. But, so I think it's a mix for us. We rely, incredibly heavily on the feedback of our customers, but I think it's also our responsibility as a high quality product company to continually be innovating internally.
Great advice about internal innovation, because I don't think that's talked about as much as people think about, because it seems to be a bit of a buzzword in terms of disruption and innovation, all those things. But when it comes down to it, you need to build a team out that you've got creative thinkers and you've got people that can actually execute on what your customers want, and also get ahead of the curve and learn and engage and handhold them through that process. Matt, one last question before we wrap it up. You started the business 3.5 years ago. You're an entrepreneur by heart, and you've built a global business that now employs 80-odd people in multiple countries. What are some tips that resonate well with you that you've learnt over those 3.5 years and or before that, and perhaps even some tips that you've learnt from your mentors and people like Nikki and Paul, etc., that you could share with others that might give them a helping hand?
Yeah, I think there's a whole bunch, and there's so many lessons I've learned, and you could talk on this topic for days, I think. But some of the big ones that certainly come to mind for me, we touched on it earlier before. One is really identifying early and often and being aggressive with hiring the right people. And always, I think, punching that kind of next level up in the kind of people that you're hiring in your company, and seeking out those that will, just by hiring them, move the needle over and above the role that you're employing them to do, or you're bringing them onto the team to do. And, you know, I think about so many of the hires that we've done in this company, where at the time we're like, oh man, that, you know, that person is slightly more expensive than what we wanted, or maybe it's too early for that role. You know, I think as long as you're being responsible financially and you're not completely blowing things out of the water, your ability, as certainly as a CEO, to identify areas that you yourself are bottlenecking the process, or you know, the lack of contribution in the team is bottlenecking your ability to keep progressing and keep moving forward. I think humility and your ability to carve that off and find wonderful people that are far better than you at doing those things and will overall, you know, help to the culture and the growth of the company is so important. So I think hiring really well and hiring, you know, a slightly ahead of the curve was really important for me and continues to be something I focus on. I think when it comes to raising money as well, you know, money and capital, you know, if you play your cards right and you do all of the right things, and I think there's some founders, by the way, that are just excellent fundraisers and they do really well on that front, you know, for me, it's a lot of hard work and it's a lot of conversations and back and forth. But I think at the end of the day, focusing only on raising money for money's sake is really dangerous in certainly an early stage company and beyond. I think it's so much more about finding the right people to have around the table, because, you know, I think for me, getting excellent mentors, excellent investors that can really help you solve the problems that you're going to face over the next 12 to 18 months after you raise is so critical. And that's been a wonderful experience for us, sort of focusing on getting the right people around the table certainly paid off for us. I think as well, if you're going to build a global company from day one, like we have with a distributed team, you need to kind of figure out the fundamentals of communication and cross-team culture as well. They're really hard things to do when you've got offices in Asia and the US and Australia, and you're trying to build this thing together and be this kind of homogenous mass that's, you know, attacking the world, but you're otherwise really distributed. I think finding really creative ways to share in one another's culture and have fun together remotely, but also always finding those opportunities where you can come together and do some face-to-face time and, you know, solve problems together and be a real company together, really important. And I think they're some of my favorite memories of the last few years, is when we've all come together. And the months after that have just been like everyone's blowing out of the park, because they're all so enthused and excited about what this company globally is doing, not just the office or the smaller team that they work in. And I think finding ways to do that daily can be really challenging, but it's really worth it if you're building a distributed team.
Matt, some tremendous insights there into Schedule O as a business and how it's grown, and also the challenges and successes of scaling the business and capital raising and all those things that an entrepreneur and a startup goes through. So thank you so much for sharing all that with us. Very much appreciated, and congratulations on what Schedule O has achieved from 3.5 years ago being based in Brisbane with an idea to where you are now. I wish you all the best in the coming years, and thanks so much for being part of this series.
Yeah, thanks, Chris. I think sometimes it feels like we're just getting started, but real pleasure talking to you, and it's happy to do it again anytime.